I am going to start skipping because we're not going to make it really to the end. Don't skip. We're part 4, chapter 5, paragraph 3. It's on page 303. Now, what we said, last week is that prayer is a way of linking up all of the elements of creation to the highest levels, and then interacting with the highest level in such a way as to justify a flow of influence from there down through all the levels to our world, as we said last week. Now, there's another element here. The goal of all of our efforts is Dvekus. Dvekus means attaching ourselves to God. That's an enormous, enormous achievement. That's not something which, of course, it comes in degrees, but still, it's an enormous achievement. Real Dvekus, real attachment is prophecy. We know that even at a time when prophecy was widespread, it was still a tiny minority. Today, no one achieves prophecy. So it becomes a kind of term without any concrete reference. Indeed, since it stands for experience, it becomes a term that makes no contact with our lives or our meaning, because it's an experience that we don't have. As Rabbi Kaplan, as one of the Ruchas, said once, that to gain entry into prophet school, the entry exam was a Mesilas Yesharim, the path of the just. You had to have finished all of that, accomplished all of that, as the entry exam. And from there on, you studied and trained to become a prophet. Now, I think most of us are in a position where we can't even get on the ladder of the entry exam. So Ramchal says, this is fairly clear and true, I think, by implication, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made available a kind of mini Dvekus, a mini Dvekus that's available to anyone without all that enormous preparation and self-transformation. In prayer, a human being has an opportunity to attach himself to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes himself available, even though the human being has not undergone all that extensive training. Of course, you'll have to make an effort. Now, if you take out the Shulchan Aruch, the dry, legal book of rules, and study the sections on the Shemona Esrei, on prayer, you'll see that the author, the Machaber, describes what today would be called a mystical experience. He says, in prayer, you lose consciousness of your physical environment altogether. You lose consciousness of your body. Your experience is filled with a certain spiritual reality. Now, that's a very great position to be in. But anyone who has made an effort to pray over years has experienced this on occasion, where everything just falls away, and each word breathes a kind of reality, a reality which your mind focuses on, and which fills the totality of your experience. And when you get to the end and you come out of it, there's a little bit of a shock. Almost like, here's where I'm standing. So this is what time it is. Hopefully you remember whether it was Shachris or Mincha or Maariv, as it works via Kavanah, whether it was morning, afternoon, or evening prayer. But the experience is really one of being out of this world. So in prayer, there's given to a person a kind of mini Dvekus, so that, number one, the concept of Dvekus will have a meaning, and also that what you're striving for will be something which you have an example of, only when you strive for it, you're under much more difficult conditions. You're out in the street, or you're at work, or you're buying and selling, or you're interacting with people, which have all sorts of stresses and strains. But at least you have an experience of what such a thing can be. That's the second element of prayer. The third element that we mentioned last week is that if you're asking God for things, then when you make your efforts during the day to get them, and you succeed, you will experience the success as a gift from God, not as the production of your own efforts, which is the truth after all. And you will not be, therefore, as likely to be taken in by the illusion that the world is a giant machine and you are manipulating it to your ends. Now, this last idea, that you're asking, you're coming before God in petition, is the key to several other remarks that he's going to make now. The fundamental idea, which I have mentioned to you on prior occasions a number of times, what do you ask for? How do you decide what to ask for and what not to ask for? For the purpose of this summary, I'm just going to mention two levels. There are really at least three. You can either ask for what you want or ask for what you need. If you ask for what you want, and if your wants are selfish, I want it because I will enjoy it. Not all wants are like that. But if we're talking about selfish wants, selfish desires, please, God, give me X because I like X. And I'll have a great time if I have X. Such a petition does have spiritual validity. It does have spiritual significance. And God may answer it because of its validity and significance. What spiritual validity and significance does it have to ask God for a 2004 Porsche because I like nice cars? We answered this once, right? What spiritual validity does such a request have? Because I acknowledge that God is running the world and that it's going to come from Him if it comes at all. That's not zero. There are a lot of people who don't even have that realization. But everyone should strive to achieve the second level, where what I ask for is means by which to serve. I'm like an employee who asks an employer for better work tools. Now, it's true. If I get better work tools, then my work is more productive. The bottom line is a profit for the employer. So in asking for the better tools, I'm asking on his behalf. And my asking is an expression of my loyalty to him and my commitment to him. Because I want to do the best possible job for him. That's the level that everyone should strive to achieve. There's a higher level beyond that, which is very exalted, which I'm not going to go into now. But that really is the level which I think everyone can work for and can achieve to a great extent, if not totally. This explains, I believe, the connection between the Shema and prayer. In law, in halacha, there's no connection whatsoever between Shema and prayer. Shema is a mitzvah that goes back to Moses. Jews said it twice a day, once in the morning, once in the evening. It's a biblical mitzvah. Prayer, according to everyone except Maimonides, prayer is rabbinic. Until the beginning of the Second Temple, people prayed when the Spirit moved them, in any language that they felt. 100 times a day, 0 times a day, once a month. Whenever they felt moved to pray, they prayed. Ramban says, when you're in trouble and you need salvation, then maybe it's a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray. Okay. But under normal conditions, prayer was totally optional. Okay, there's a place that says, not exactly like that. All right, I'm not going through all the possible opinions. The men of the Great Assembly said a Jew has to pray twice a day, morning and afternoon. Just as the sacrifices are morning and afternoon, so a person has to pray twice a day, morning and afternoon. And they fixed a certain text for prayer that one has to use. And the lion's share of the text is petition. And they said, in the morning, you have to put the prayer next to the Shema. And it's forbidden to interrupt between saying the Shema and reciting the prayer. That's not at all obvious. Why they did that? What's one thing got to do with the other? There's no connection between the Shema and the sacrifices. And then the prayer is made to correspond to and integrate with the sacrificial order. So why would you put the two together? And if you pray at night, so then also, and that was Rishus, also it should be connected to the Shema and there should be no separation, no break. Why not? Given what I just told you, though, you can see a thematic connection between them. Because in the Shema, you declare that you are a servant of God. That's what you're saying. It's Kabbalah Zomach L'Shamayim. You're accepting the yoke of heaven on you. Now, having accepted the yoke of heaven upon yourself, having declared yourself to be a servant of God, you come before God and ask Him for those means that will enable you to serve Him better. So the connection is gold, understanding what it is you're asking for. That's why there shouldn't be a break. Who's coming before God to make petitions? A person who has identified himself as God's servant. Fits together. Cast over Pharaoh, as they say. Now, similarly, he says, in the morning we put on talis and tefillin. Here too, the mitzvot of talis and tefillin have nothing to do with prayer. Talis and tefillin go back to Moses' time, maybe tefillin only when they came into the land of Israel. They were done for 1,000 years before prayer became organized and regular. Talis, as we said at the beginning of the fourth part of the circumstantial mitzvah, if you happen to put on a four-corner garment, make sure it has fringes on it. If you don't wear four-corner garments, you could never see a fringe. And tefillin you're supposed to put them on in the morning, keep them on all day. If you have them on all day, you can continue wearing them into the night. This is just a mitzvah to have tefillin on. So there's no connection whatsoever between tefillin, talis and tefillin on one hand and prayer on the other. Nevertheless, everybody throughout the world has a custom that before you pray in the morning, you put on a talis. Okay, most have taken that to apply only when you're a married man. But, you know, it's not exactly obvious why that is. The German communities and many Sephardic communities, when a child becomes 13, he wears a talis. What is there about getting married that suddenly makes a talis preparation for prayer didn't happen before you were married? It's not at all clear. There's a Gemara tradition about covering the head. So, most of the world just, the person doesn't cover his head with a talis until he's married. They put it on beforehand and they cover it afterwards, but they wear it from before. At any rate, but for married men, there's a special talis. He's wearing a small talis cotton. He has the mitzvah tzitzis, he has it on all day, but he puts on another one to pray with. What for? So they have to do prayer. And why those people, those of us today, almost everybody, who don't wear tefillin all day, but for prayer, you put it on tefillin. Put it on before the beginning, so you have it on for Shema, you have it on for prayer. Why would there be any connection between these mitzvahs, which, in terms of their legal structure, are not connected at all? So Ramchal says that one element of both tzitzis and tefillin, one element, we'll talk about others in a minute, is that they are insignia of the servant of the king. Today, in Western democratic countries, you can't tell the Secretary of State from the Secretary. A secretary who sharpens pencils. Now, they both wear business suits. But there was a time when the Prime Minister wore a special insignia. And Condoleezza Rice would have a special crown as chief security in the whole country, the United States. So here, this is like an insignia, that we are servants of the king. Now, you're coming before God. as a person who has declared in the Shema that he's a servant of the king, and in the prayer you're going to ask God for means by which you can serve him better, that's a good time to have on those elements, those elements which are insignia of your being a servant of the king. That's why putting on the special talis and wearing tefillin as a preparation for prayer fits. One thing that you need to understand methodologically here is that connections can be made in practice on levels that are not straightforwardly legal. These reasons that I'm giving you have nothing to do with the laws as laws. They have to do with the themes expressed by the law. The themes expressed by the laws are not just window dressing. They're not just comments thought of by people with great imaginations. They're also part of the tradition. And being part of the tradition, they can lead to forms of practice. So that's the connection between, the direct connection between talis, tefillin, and prayer. There's another connection. We spoke about tefillin last week. That tefillin puts a person in a position to pull down energy, influence, from God to himself, into himself. Into himself personally. The tefillin are on the head, opposite the heart, on the arm, and the root of the energy is from head to heart, and then out to the rest of the body. The tefillin are enablers for the energy to take that root and suffuse the person. Now, at a time where the activity of prayer, the business of prayer, is to address a very high level and to enable energy to flow from that high level down through the intermediaries into our world, to have on tefillin, whose job it is to enable energy to flow into me as an individual person, it's complementary activities. Activities which center around the same theme and therefore reinforce one another. So again, it's a good reason to have that at the time of prayer. Yeah?
Does that mean that when you cross tefillin, you get pulling down energy or whatever it is from a high level? Does that mean that when you put on the tefillin, you wouldn't normally get that energy into you, but the tefillin enables it to get into you? And also, if you put on tefillin when that energy is not coming down, but you're not in prayer, then you only get the energy that's on your level.
No, they're separate items. Prayer is addressed to one level, and tefillin is addressed to a different level.
Right.
So, I don't see any connection that you're asking about. Prayer is addressed to box A of energy, and tefillin is addressed to box B of energy. But when you're in the process and you're focused on that general project of reaching out for higher levels and trying to interact with them and absorb energy from them, so then to have them interacting with one another is a good thing. Yeah.
If the original block is to wear tefillin all day,
right,
when the ritual was done, there's currently a mitzvah, I guess, to mention musaf, to remove them from musaf, the head of ritualizing them. Why is that? I mean, it would seem to me if you're going to come up with prayer, you could offer all the davening, including musaf.
Yeah, you're speaking of Rosh Chodesh. That's the only musaf that they're available. The other times it's Yom Tov, and you're not wearing it the whole day.
And
Chol HaMoed also, right. Well, it's rather that Rosh Chodesh has an aspect of holiday about it, and to wear the tefillin at a time when you're emphasizing the aspect of holiday, where the holiday is a time when you don't wear tefillin, it's like a contradiction. Exactly the same thing. Those who wear tefillin when they go to Musaf, when you're in Musaf, what you're saying is today is a holiday. In its identity as a holiday, you shouldn't be wearing tefillin. So even if you hold that you have to wear it because it's a semi-holiday and it's a time when you're going to go to work anyhow, even so, the aspect that emphasizes that it's holiday, that you won't wear it for. Because the themes are incompatible.
But it would seem that if the law has to wear it all day, it would seem that if here's an opportunity to wear it, I guess for an additional portion of the day rather than simply remove it. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why we don't wear it all day. You know, one of which is practicality. But wouldn't it be? I mean, but that doesn't seem to to me at least, it doesn't seem to apply when I'm in school davening that, you know, we finish reading the Torah, we put it away, and then I take my tefillin off. I mean, certainly I could wear it during Musaf without, you know, with any of the reasons why we don't wear it, you know, when I go to work.
You're right. You're right. I'm just asking how I can explain it better. Now, I'll give you an analogy. It's not a perfect analogy, but maybe it'll help. The Gemara says, what happens in Babylonia on Sukkot when they didn't know when the holiday started? And you come to, so the first day might be day zero, and it might not be the holiday at all, it might be day one. You come to day seven, might be seven or six. You come to day eight, it might be eight or seven. Now if it's seven, you've got to sit in the Sukkot. If it's eight, it's Shmini Atzeres, you can't sit in the Sukkot. So what do you do? Well, it's a doubt. And this is a doubt, and the mitzvah d'oraisa, to sit in the Sukkah, you have to sit in the Sukkah. That's what the Gemara says. But you don't make a blessing. Why don't you make a blessing? Because you're celebrating it as if it were Shmini Atzeres, a separate holiday. How can you celebrate at Shmini Atzeres and say that it's a Sukkah? What do you mean? But I'm sitting in it, am I not? I'm sitting in it, because I have to sit in it. And since it's a doubt, and since on the basis of the doubt, I resolve the doubt legally by saying I have to sit there, so then the law is that I have to sit there. If I have to sit there, why shouldn't I say the blessing? Because it's ridiculous to make Kiddush for Shmini Atzeres and then say you're sitting in the Sukkah. The words come out as a contradiction. So even though legally, on such a day when it's doubtful, I do have to sit in the Sukkah, but to say it becomes almost like a joke that, you know, you're making Kiddush between the Atzeres, and then you're saying the Baruch Al Tzedi in the Sukkah. You're saying that it's eight and seven in the same breath. Even though the law is, I've got to do this because it might be eight, and I've got to do that because it might be seven. So the laws are completely consistent, but the expression is not consistent. Now, here it's not perfect because you're talking about a kiyum of a mitzvah deraisa, and tefillin is much stronger than just making a blessing. But here also, to davened the Shemona Esrei that said it's Yom Tov, and to wear tefillin is to be expressing contradictory themes as you stand there. So now on Rosh Chodesh you say, but it's not contradictory because there's clearly a mitzvah to wear it on Rosh Chodesh. That's true, but the aspect of Rosh Chodesh, which is Yom Tov Tik, which is like a holiday, that aspect would be what that is one that doesn't integrate with tefillin. So the incompatibility in your case, in the case of Rosh Chodesh and tefillin, is not as strong as the one that I'm pointing out, as the one in Sukkot, but it's a similar idea. You know, it's very interesting. They ask on Rosh Chodesh when you daven Musaf, don't say Mipnei Chataeinu, because of our sins the temple was destroyed. On Shabbos, when you say Musaf, you don't say, because of our sins, the temple is destroyed. But on Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, you do. What is there in the combination of Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh? Shabbos doesn't enable you to say it, and Rosh Chodesh doesn't enable you to say it, but Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh enables you to say it. So, one explanation is that, why on holidays do you say it? Do you say it? Because holidays have two factors together. They have a prohibition against doing malacha, and you have the extra sacrifice. Shabbos, you have prohibition against doing malacha, and you have the Yom Tov. You have the Yom Tov Musaf. Shabbos, you don't have the Yom Tov Musaf. Rosh Chodesh, you don't have a prohibition against malacha. Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, you have the combination. So what Rosh Chodesh is contributing is a Yom Tov Tikkun Musaf. It's a Yom Tov Tikkun Musaf. It happens to be a day in which you're allowed to do malacha, a regular Rosh Chodesh. But it's Yom Tov Tikkun Musaf. If it's a Yom Tov Tikkun Musaf, so the expression is expression of a Yom Tov theme. If it's an expression of a Yom Tov theme, to be wearing tefillin at the same time is like expressing contradictory themes. That's the best I can do for you. I can't say any better than that. It's a good question. We should look up and see if I can find a better way to explain it. Yeah.
Before we had the that we're not supposed to put on stone all day. It's
when they put on tefillin all day, if it was Rosh Chodesh, would they take it off?
That's a good question. I don't know. There are people who wear tefillin all day. I don't even know some of them, so I can ask them what they do.
Rosh Chodesh, they take it off. Put it back on.
That's the key question, because there are still people today who wear it all day long. And I don't know what they do when it comes to Moses. If they do take it off, I'll ask someone that related to me. So I'll ask and see if they do. If they do, I'll try to see what the explanation is. Yeah? Okay, now he makes another remark about tzitzis, which I think is extremely important. He says that it's the obligation, project of a Jew to sanctify the whole of his environment. And that includes his clothes. By putting tzitzis on your garments, you are, number one, sanctifying would be too strong. You're spiritualizing the garment. It's not holy, according to legally holy. You're spiritualizing the garment itself, and number one, you're expressing the theme of spiritualizing the environment as a whole. Let me just give you a little wider background on this idea. You say the Shema. You read the Shema, the first paragraph of the Shema. So you have God's unity, and then you should love God with all your heart, soul, and resources. And the words that I'm commanding you to say should be on your heart. And you should teach them to your children, or train your children in them. And you should speak of them when you're at home, when you're walking by the way, when you lie down, and when you wake up. Constant preoccupation with these words. And don't forget leather boxes on your arm and on your head, and parchments on your doorways. To me, on the surface, it's a little anticlimactic. You're talking about God's unity, loving God, meditating on His words, training your children, and thinking of them and reciting them under all conditions, and leather boxes, leather straps, and mezuzahs. How is that a fitting ending to these very exalted spiritual ideas? So, in simple terms, you could say, the leather straps and boxes and the rest are supposed to remind you of those things. You have them on all the time. You walk through the doorway and you see them. And they're constant reminders. And I don't say that that's wrong. I think there's also a much broader idea here. And that is that religion is not just meditation, attitudes, feelings, beliefs. That was the Greek influence on the Western world to spiritualize all religion into intangibles. The message of the Torah is that spirituality has to infuse the entire physical environment. We do not recognize an absolute distinction, an absolute divorce between what's called the spiritual and what's the physical. That's a Greek idea which invaded Christianity to a great extent, and something that Torah never recognized. Spirituality has to affect your clothes, and it has to affect your houses, and it has to affect the gates of your city, and the way you plow your field, and everything. Nothing is beyond the reach of spirituality. So here also, you put the fringes on your garments, and you thereby spiritualize them. Now, how do the fringes spiritualize the garments? What connection is there? Here there are also levels. The simplest level is, if you're doing what God said, it's already spiritual. Even if you had no understanding whatsoever, God said put on the strings, you put them in because He said so. When you look at them, you know I'm doing what God told me to do. That's a connection with God. But the Torah says more than that. The Torah says you'll see them and you'll remember all of God's commandments. Now, how does seeing the fringes remind the person of all of God's commandments? So there, the Gemara says two ways. Or Rashi. One is numerically. We mentioned this last week, I think. The word tzitzis, calculated appropriately, gives you a value of 600. To do that, you got to put in an extra yud. But if you have a chiruk, the yud is there by understanding. For the sake of gematria, you're allowed to do that. We spoke about that last week. Then you have five knots and eight strings hanging down. This knot is 13. There's 613 commands. Also, when we had the trelis, the color of the tchelis is similar to that of the sea. The sea is similar to the color of the heavens. The heavens are similar to the color of the throne of glory. So by looking at the blue thread, your mind is attached to the throne of glory. So it means that wearing the tzitzis and experiencing the tzitzis focuses a person's mind on spiritual things. That's what it means to spiritualize the garment. What makes the garment spiritual? That it interacts in a positive, reinforcing way with human spirituality. We're not personifying the garment here. We're not pretending that the garment prays to God or the garment keeps Shabbos or whatever. But it becomes a vehicle through which the person's spirituality can be enhanced. Now, I don't remember, I mentioned this last week, but it's just a little point of logic, and because I'm a logician, it's hard for me to resist. If we say that the blue-green thread is similar to the sea, and the sea is similar to the heavens, and the heavens are similar to the throne of glory, and you're connecting up, why not skip the intermediary steps and just say that the blue-green thread is similar to the throne of glory? And you're connected. Why go through the intermediary steps?
You can't see a blue thread and just think of the throne of glory. You have to take the steps. You think first, it would just be natural reason to think. You'd see blue and see, think of the green and see the blue and see. And then from that, he has to go through the steps in order to really come to the.
Let's skip out the sea at least. Yeah. Right? I mean, it's true. You need a verse that tells you that the throne is the same color as the heavens, but that you need a verse. You don't know that. Rashi says you yourself can observe that the color of the thread is the same as the sea is the same as the heavens. But why not jump over that? Or if the verse says that it's similar, so then just look at the thread and recognize its similarity to the throne of glory, right? And jump over the middle steps. There's a logical mistake here, boys and girls. If A is similar to B, and B is similar to C, and C is similar to D, it does not follow that A is similar to D. Similarity means there's still a measure of difference, and differences accumulate every step you go. It may simply not be true that the thread looks like the throne of glory. No, the thread looks like the sea, somewhat, you know, within 10%. And the sea looks like the heavens, within 10%. And the heavens look like the throne of glory within 10%, but the thread is 30% off the throne of glory. It doesn't look like it at all. And therefore, you have to go through the intermediary stage, which means connecting yourself to the throne of glory.
Or in Aramaic, where I say pitkatova, meaning you should have a good sealed judgment delivered on this day. That's why we stay up at night. Staying up at night is because it's an inyan of. We want to have this closing, this final sealing of the judgment and delivery of it, which is going to determine everything for us in the year to come. We want to have the merits that go with it, the merits of staying up at night. Some people stay up at night and say particular kinds of tikkun, would they say, particular prayers in our Shiva circles. It's done in terms of staying up and learning. That's what we're involved in right now. So all of those things are aspects of what Hashanah Rabbah is all about. But I want to call attention to the very first aspect of it. We talk about this idea of a Zecher LeMikdash. Chazal did a number of things which were there, the purpose of them is that we should identify with the Beit HaMikdash, which we unfortunately have not yet been zeichet to have built in our time. But there's a concept, the Navi says, Tzion hi deirish einu. Tzion doesn't have anybody searching for it, seeking it. So that indicates to us that we should be seeking it. How can we seek Tzion? What do you do? It isn't like some people think that you go up on Har HaBayis, you go up on Temple Mount where you do it, an Avera which can bring you an Issur Karas. That's not the idea of how we are do it. We do our remembering and our associating, identifying with the Beis HaMikdash through those things that our sages, that the Chazal determine are things that will help us to connect with that. On Sukkot you have more than in any other Yontif, you have these dimensions of Zecher LeMikdash. We had one, which we were doing all Sukkos. In the time of the Beis Hamikdash, Lulav and Esri, Arba Minim, was taken for 7 days in the Beis Hamikdash alone. Outside of the Beis Hamikdash, it was done only on one day. Because that's the way the Torah writes it. The first day you'll take the Arba Minim, Prince Hagar, all those things. And in the Beis Hamikdash, Shmachtem, Lefnei Hashem, and Akegem, you'll rejoice before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lefnei Hashem, before God. Whereas before Hashem in the Beis Hamikdash, for Shivas Yom, 7 days. After the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, came along the head of the Sanhedrin, at that time Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, we can't just forget what was done in the Beis Hamikdash. We have to identify with this. He made a takana that we take, wherever we are, we take the lulav and esrei for 7 days. That's the Zeicher LeMikdash 1. A second Zeicher LeMikdash we did the other night, Simchas Beis HaShoeva. This is Zeicher LeMikdash, because they did the dancing every day. We did it one day. That's what's done throughout Yerushalayim, all yeshivas and shuls, where you have this Simchas Beis HaShoeva, Zeicher LeMikdash. And finally, the Zeicher LeMikdash, which he mentioned about the Arava. They took an Arava every day, and what do we do it? On one day. By the way, why do you think there's a difference? Why is it that they saw fit to make a Zeicher LeMikdash by Lulav and Esrei for 7 days, just the way they did the Beis HaMikdash? As far as a Rava they did also 7 days. Why is a Rava done only one day? Huh? Any idea? Anybody want to take a try at it? What is different about the Mitzvah Lulav and Esrei that they saw fit to make the Zeicher for 7 days, and as far as the Mitzvah of a Rava, only one day? Today you can.
What they represent?
No. Okay, I'll do it very simply. Yes.
We had a mitzvah lulav and lulav.
Right, lulav. We had a mitzvah of one day everywhere. Since we had a mitzvah for the Torah for one day wherever we were, so therefore that mitzvah is so important that what? That we made it, for 7 days as a Zeicher LeMikdash. A Rava, there was no mitzvah of the Torah to do a Rava outside of the Beis HaMikdash. But here is a very interesting point. A Rava we see from the Gemara, that's some one day when you learn the Perek Lulav a Rava and you learn the Sukkah, you see an interesting question that the Gemara asks. And the question and the answer determine something which a lot of people are not aware of. The Gemara asks, where is the source of the mitzvah Rava? This mitzvah we're going to do tomorrow, Zeicher LeMikdash, where's the source of it altogether? It doesn't say in the Torah. In the Torah it just talks about taking the four minim and shaking them on the 7 days of Yom Tov in Beis HaMikdash, one day outside. A Rava we mentioned, Halacha LeMoshe Messina. This was Moshe Rabbeinu received orally, it was not recorded. So, the mitzvah of Rava, we find a machlokes in the Gemara between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, whether the mitzvah of a Rava was Yisoid HaNeviim or Minhig HaNeviim. What do those words mean? Yisoid HaNeviim means that the Neviim ordained it. The Neviim made a takana, what we call a derabana. The Neviim made a takana that you should take a Rava when? Even outside, That doesn't say what. It says the mitzvah of a Rava was takana of the Neviim. The other opinion, and that's the one we abide by, is that it wasn't that takana of the Neviim dictated you got to do this. It was a minig that they instituted. It was a nice thing that they encouraged people to do as a custom. Asks the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan was the one who said that the Neviim are the ones who instituted, but Rabbi Yochanan is the same person who said that it's halacha l'moshe m'sinai. What did Rabbanu have a need? What did the Neviim have a need to institute a mitzvah of a Rava if there's a halacha l'moshe m'sinai? You know what the answer is? Halacha l'moshe m'sinai was in the Beis HaMikdash. Outside of the Beis HaMikdash is what the Neviim instituted. We see from that Gemara a fascinating point, that even in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, Chagi, Zechariah, and Malachi, the last of the Neviim, who were there at the beginning of the second base of Mikdash, they got the people to do, and that's where we ask it, it's Minig Nevi'im, not Yisoy Nevi'im, meaning they got the people to start doing a custom of outside of the base of Mikdash of doing a rova one day. What we do today is simply a continuation of that minig. So it's not the same as our Luliv and Esrig. Luliv and Esrig, 7 days that the Yeshua ben Zakkai was Mesakin, you know, we make a bracha every day because we make a bracha on the mitzvah of the Rabbanim. We don't make a bracha tomorrow on our Rava. Why not?